Folks, let's go. Does that sound okay? Yeah? I can't get used to this. It's like the sort of thing that those folk that work in sports shops use to get the trainers up from the basement. Jimmy, size 11 Nike. Which is another class-filled comment for a segue into a lecture. I'm going to try and do this every week. A lecture on the novel in class, which is our subject today. And these are the four main things that we're going to think about that structure a lecture. Maybe in the two halves, two and two, maybe neatly, maybe not. We're going to think about the way that I'm sure Pablo told you in his introductory lecture way back when, that the growth of the novel, in Europe especially, is in many ways consonant and concomitant with the growth of the middle classes in power and size. We all know the story about the 19th century being that great century of revolution, right? And in many ways, the growth and power of the middle classes is at the very center of that revolutionary ferment. The way that they see their own particular interests served and attempt to wrest interest away from both aristocracy and, in a sense, create a working class and organize them in such a way becomes a kind of story in many ways of the century's class relations. And the novel itself becomes something that tends to mirror those particular preoccupations. So, we're going to be talking about the middle classes today, obviously, but mostly the novel, because we're looking at Germinal and Barocca, we're going to think about the way that the novel itself as a genre opens itself up as a larger vehicle for class representation per se. Because of the kind of breakthroughs that Zola and subsequent artists make in the late 19th century, such a thing as the working class novel, related to, but distinct and away from the working class in the novel, becomes like an important feature of the 20th century. And a figure like Barocca in Spain becomes an important feature in kind of like a genre of fiction which is less known in working class literature or the working class novel, which is effectively the proletarian novel in modernism, the modernist proletarian novel. So we want to think in many ways about a bridge between the two today. That's going to be, in a sense, our trajectory. So I also want to think about ways that we can define class, because of course this becomes an important feature of the political economy of the time. We're going to think about the way that Marx represents class. We can't not think about that when we talk about Zola. And also other ways and different or related concerns, particularly the idea of class, not necessarily defined purely through an economic lens, but more to do with things to do with culture, status, inheritance, and so on. Maybe one's position as a consumer dictates where one is as a class, the sort of thing that we would be much more aware of, I guess, in the neoliberal age. All right, but let's just put that one aside for the present. And hopefully by the end of the lecture, we'll end up thinking about the way that modernism creates a particular type, we all know this anyway, right? We know that it creates a new form for the novel, a challenge in some respect for the novelist to kind of confront. And how does that affect the way that we think about class relations in a society at a particular moment in time? That's what we're going to look at Barocca for. But let's go back, right? Let's go back to Anna Karenina. Thinking about a particular conversation between Anna and Levin, one of the few times that they meet, towards the close of the novel. And the conversation turns to what's to refer to, and this is quote number one on your sheet, but they're also mirrored up here, as the new trend in art, right? To the new Bible illustrations by a French artist. Vorkuev accused the artist of realism, pushed to the point of coarseness. Pushed to the point of coarseness. Now, on the back of that Zola lecture last week, this should already be ringing bells, right? This kind of offense, in some respect, that art, or the new art, because he's talking about naturalism, has on the culture of middle classes. Levin, however, right, close to the peasants as he is portrayed throughout Anna Karenina, speaks up for the French capacity to create new artistic conventions. Now, remember, we've also got an interesting organization in the transportation of the novel form and its dissemination in Russia. A lot of these artists, especially Russian artists, are reading French realist and naturalist fiction because new stagecoaches and new modes of transportation, particularly almost a long-distance train, is reaching into Moscow from Paris. And it's bringing a whole series of new artistic conventions, methods, and products, right? And writers go backwards and forwards. So we've got an interesting new channel, in some respects, for the novel to move backwards and forwards in. So we see the influence, in many ways, on the Russian intellectuals of French artists like Zola. And Levin himself speaks, he says that he saw poetry, right, in the fact that they were no longer lying. This is Levin's idea. He defends these new French artists. He saw poetry and the fact that they were no longer lying. Anna confirms that he's talking of Zola. And Levin feels some kind of satisfied glow at his astute comment. Now, in the backdraft of Germinal, and for our topic today, this is a significant moment in Anna Karenina, a novel that pushes discussion of the worker-peasant condition further than most of the other texts that we studied prior to that. Think, however, about Dostoevsky's famous cynical comment about Tolstoy's work. He called it landowner's literature. Landowner's literature. And he scoffed at it. And this becomes a kind of pertinent gesture for us to think about in considering the quality and also, I guess, the degree of realism in the class representations and in the class perspectives present in novels like Anna Karenina, which, of course, is the apotheosis of the realist novel in the 19th century, after Balzac and so on, okay, Dickens and that whole bunch of 1830s English novelists. Think in particular, right, to the famous scene when Levin joins his peasants mowing. Remember that one? He works very hard for a day. And at the end of that day, he sleeps well. The next day, he does the same thing again. But this time, he sits in an elevated, restful position above the meadow and watches the peasants going at it again, right? Scything away as they do, because this is prime mover mechanisms, a wholly different form of human energy and labor. And he's fatigued by working in the field, but he gets to lie down in a haystack. And he admires a meadow teeming with peasants. And this is the second part of this quotation. From this position, he downplays the possibility of peasants or musics holding any malice towards the landowner, i.e. him. And it's a thought that's, quote, drowned out in the sea of common, cheerful labor. And whom was this labor for? What would its fruits be? These considerations were irrelevant and insignificant. That's a brilliantly ambivalent formulation, isn't it? Because, of course, we take, the indirect manner of the narration, we take up Levin's particular position, which is one of ignorance in many respects, but at the same time we're made aware of hard labor. These considerations were irrelevant and insignificant. What's missing from that may be, to Levin, the extent to which we are supposed to sympathize with his position, however, is unclear. The novelist, as many good novelists do, is placing this confrontation and realization upon the reader. We have to work out what class interests operate here. Now remember, the relevance and significance of these sentiments historically, right, is magnified, especially as we turn this week to the kind of literature Anna and Levin discuss as displaying a new realist determination in pursuit of what it itself saw as a wider range of truth and commentary for the novel form, garnered by a necessary refurbishment of the novel's representative capacities in language, perspective, description, and so on, as we've seen already in the scientific ideas of Germinal and naturalism generally. The volatile and central issue of class and class conflict had become more important for the middle classes to discuss and to take on board as the century progressed. And if we go back briefly to Anna Karenina, this is crucial, right, if we think retrospectively, because, of course, the type of sentiments that are being said here, for those of us that know what happens around the corner at the very beginning of the 20th century in Russia, are unbelievably, they're crackling with static, right? They're saying, who gives a toss about what these poor wee peasants think? This is all kind of good, right? We're all being happy. Now, we can take that rustic position of the feudal landowner, fair enough. But we know that at the very same time, other developments are happening in Russian society. The serfs are being emancipated and heavily proletarianized. People are moving from the countryside into the city, from the plow to the factory. And the subsequent consequences of that will be a massive and bloody and long-lasting revolution, which will form the story of the 20th century. So this form of ignorance, in some respects, needs to be kind of localized within, perhaps, the character himself. But it's a larger political point about class and class relations. And, you know, basically, do not think that these people can go unheeded, that the novelist seeks the reader to discern. So, we have the growth of the novel and novels like this throughout the 19th century, and increasing amounts of them to think about as well. It's a century, as you know, of increasing literacy and education, not only for the middle classes, but mostly, of course, for that sector. But we get an increasing political and social representation too. The question, indeed, of forms of representation becomes crucial. We are, of course, dealing with a novel, right? A representative form. The political themes of Germinal, if you think about it, are collective forms of representation. How does an individual represent an unseen or hitherto unrepresented collective? How do you represent them as a union leader? And how do you represent them as an artist? The two realms are brought together in the novel. And of course, in, you know, just as an incidental, right, it's interesting too, isn't it, that there are cracks and leaks all the way through, fissures in class anxiety that appear through just about all the novels that you've thought about. I mean, you know, is it turkeys or chickens at the end of Emma? I can never really remember. Is that a chicken or a turkey? There's a thief who's nicking chickens, right? Don't get your chickens or your turkeys mixed up. The people that are listening to the recording of this are thinking, what is he on about? At the end of Emma, everything's good. Everything's tied together, right? Everybody's married. But there's a worry, a nagging anxiety about others that are somehow stealing property, right? Now, this carries on, of course, through Dickens, through the the worry of Pip, for example, as he becomes a gentleman and a gentleman, about falling back through into the class that he subsequently jumped out of. We have the horrendous, by the way, I think, representative disaster of Joe Gargery, right? The happy working class blacksmith guy in that novel to think about. Always a problem for me, maybe not for you. We have, if you think about it, in Madame Bovary, that horrifying end where Emma's dependents end up in the workhouse. So that anxiety of not aspiring, of bearing through all the ambitious movement upwards and consolidations within one's class and realms of prosperity and security is always there in the novel form. It's a great plot and psychological device, the idea of falling backwards. It makes us also aware of the fact that there is a larger pool, a larger reservoir of existence out there. And oftentimes, the novel itself, as a middle-class vehicle, can tend to get very worried about not representing that. And of course, Zola comes along and blows that apart in many ways. That's not to say, of course, that we can't read these forms of revolutionary activity in just about all the other novels, too. I mean, Raskolnikov's gesture could be seen, of course, as a great gesture of radical proletarian revolution, right? I mean, he attacks not necessarily a landowner, but certainly a property holder, someone that he sees as exploiting other people in the same position. So we have a worry about the people underneath, if you like. But we also have this extension of these people in the novel and their experience of the novel, right? So Germinal's fame, as I've said, just to go over some ground I've already covered, it's a central global novel about class conflict, class difference, class emergence, collective emergencies of the collective emergency and emergence of the proletarian class and so on. It itself is named after the seventh month of the French Revolutionary calendar. Again, as I said last week, associated with insurrection, rioting, poverty, starvation, and all feature in the central story of the eruption and the failure of a general strike and its universally negative outcome. It might be a negative outcome for everyone, but who is worse off by the end? It's a question the novel wants you to think about. Now, the main narrative, of course, charts Etienne Lanty is emotional and political assimilation into a particular mining community and therefore mining class, illuminating a dark, disenfranchised world ripe for revolt. And Etienne's progression from neutral outsider to committed strike leader mobilizes a collective struggle subtly presented in tandem with the contradictions and compromises of individual beliefs and aspirations. He becomes their secretary in many respects, right? He is the union secretary. He becomes a scribe for their experiences eventually. We're going to worry later on, and you should be worried in some respects, we're supposed to recognize this, about what it means for Etienne to leave after the failure and the collapse. What does that mean in terms of class interests, in terms of class betrayal, for example, or conversely, moving to a higher realm of class power and representation? I mean, it might be a good thing that Etienne moves to Paris. He has experience, after all, of the type of life that he's fighting for, okay? So we have across the whole gamut of 19th century culture a concern with the subjects of working class life. And of course, we can see this just as a wee gift, right, in the middle of this lecture. Where's the light and stuff? There it is. We can see this in most of the art already throughout the century, right? And remember, of course, Zola is inspired by a lot of these artists. This is, of course, Gustave Courbet's Quarrymen. I'm going to go through these quite quickly. We see the winnowers, you know, look at the exhaustion, the elevation is important too, right? I mean, a lot of the kind of like visual metaphors here are about the crushing effects of labor. We see the same in Mie's Man with a Hoe. Peasants, and especially peasants who work the land, become an important feature for the political gestures of participatory art, plein air art. Okay, get out into the field. That was Gustave Courbet's ideas for realism. And of course, Zola picks up on these with his ethnographic aspirations. You need to get out there and live among the people in order to really capture and represent them accurately. Because stereotypes and inaccurate representations of working class figures are legion, right? I mean, they exist throughout. So how to do it properly? Put them in the center of the frame and make the back-breaking element of labor important to see. Same thing here. This is a very famous painting, of course, especially the same year as, I think, Madame Bovary's published, but you see the landowner in the background and a hugely significant figure on an elevated position on the horse. Yeah? Someone looking over the process itself. It's an interesting kind of representation of power in many respects. Almost out of frame. This is, of course, enormously famous. Urban subjects of working class life become increasingly important for the impressionists that Zola himself champions. This is Manet's courtesan, who's, you know, someone who's more or less Nana models herself on prostitute. We see people in the pub, of course, people somewhat worse for wear with that famous drink. And then we see also, interestingly, depictions of middle class labor as well. Not necessarily something that we should forget. The white-collar element of exploitation is increasingly important. And of course, it has become even more so, right, in terms of the movement away from mass industrial production that we've experienced ourselves in neoliberalism, for example, right? I mean, the element of the call center worker being someone who doesn't necessarily work at a coalface, but is nonetheless exploited the same way or has the same relations of industrial production and labor and tiring features throughout the day becomes an important feature of the 19th century office workers too, especially in bureaucracy. Always interlaced with depictions of the bourgeois at leisure, okay? So you'll see this in two different paintings by Georges Seurat, post-impressionist painter emerging and writing about the same time as Germinal, of restful positions on a Sunday afternoon, right? The day of leisure. Confronted by the same painter's very famous painting of the bathers at Asnières, you see the factory smoke in the background. You can just about make that out there. Yeah? These are working class people who would be working in the factories in the background at leisure. We can map that onto the kind of like small festivalized moments in Zola where you know, we see maybe 2 or 3 days off every 6 months or something where people basically they have a lot of fun. Let's just put it that way. Okay. So let's just look at one thing for 5 minutes to do with oppositions, given that I've left you with an opposition there visually. I'm going to put the lights back on. The novel itself operates through a series of aesthetic oppositions. It's very clear. Political and aesthetic oppositions are obvious. That's just something I made up myself here, so you can add to it, right? I mean, you could put heaven and hell. There's a various kind of set of mythological kind of like oppositions that work their way through the text. But you'll see that sometimes this works in parallel sequences, as if Zola is trying to make us much more aware of the oppositional conflict involved in the meeting of the two classes together at some point in history. And we see this, I think, on a famous passage from this sense of the kind of fundamental opposition between two opposed classes. In a redolent scene, if I can find it, I think I've given it on your handout, is that right? On the back of your handout. I've quickly photocopied it. Yep, from Germinal, from part 4, chapter 2. Do you see that? Okay. winter. Oh, there it is. That was a rubbish bit anyway. So, sorry, that was brief, but, you know, you're lucky you get one at all. I drive a hard bargain. So, think of that last section there, of that small quote, right? Some miners choose to sit down, some stand up, some are, we don't really know, they're a bit of a rabble as such. Now, they're going to be organized, we know, into a class that finally comes to some kind of consciousness and agreement that their life and their working conditions, especially, it's a bad deal. It doesn't work for them. Etienne, in some respects, has to be the glue for that. The novel works through different variant positions on European socialism, of course. We see this in a lot of the bar dialogues between Souverine, the anarchist Rasseneur, who's a different kind of like revolutionary form of socialist, and so on. We get barroom drunkards who pontificate about various things. But Etienne's position is seen as the one that's most logical. Okay, drive through by peaceable means, change. Now, by this stage, of course, this is already happening in many respects. Unions are starting to rise up, to form throughout the late 19th century, built on ideas about what this new class might mean and what it should aspire to. Because they know that power is massively, unevenly distributed. Not only representative power, but political and is also economic power. And we get this, if you think about it, throughout the novel at the beginning, right up to the very end when everything collapses again. We see an indistinct clamor of voices, for example, at the very beginning of Germinal. Remember, Etienne talks to old Bonnemort, and he can't even finish his sentence because, bodily, he's been affected by the labor process, right? He has this kind of silicosis. So he starts ranting on about the vagaries of international capital and how crap it is working underneath the mine. And then he just bursts out into a fit of coughing, which is taken away by the howling wind, as the narrative tells us. The implication, of course, is that the novelist and this novel will fill that voice. And one of the most famous things said about Germinal is by Irving Howe, an American critic from the 1970s, where he said that the great power of Germinal is it's the first novel in which the dumb learn to speak. Slightly patronizing thing, I think, but nonetheless, there we are. The dumb learn to speak. And if you remember, one of the great culminations of Mahu is when he presents his chest, to his bare chest, to the bayonets of the state security forces, is finding his voice. Eventually, he says and voices his concerns. It's an interesting moment. If you think about the working class novel as some people do, as a Nor was there death. This keeps turning off. That's why I'm now conscious of. I don't know why it does that, right? I'm really sorry if people in the night class. Because of their lack of initiative, understanding, and skill, could never graduate from their apprenticeship. They were also gypsies, mule, and dog clippers. Nor was there a dearth, I should say dearth, of porters. There's a few deaths of porters. Itinerant barbers and mountebanks. So mountebanks are people who, con men, basically, people who deceive folk. Almost all of them, if opportunity offered, stole what they could. They all presented the same pauperized, emaciated look, and all harbored a constant rage that vented itself in furious imprecations and blasphemies. And then these gaps. Broca is very fond of these paragraph gaps, as if to make you aware of the kind of like disparate element that the narrative is trying to project. And it's in many ways often a completely fragmented narrative in order to try and work this world of fragmentation through, right? This world that's either what the new world of modernity or the old world of tradition, and also a world that's tremendously uneven and economically depressed. How do you survive in this world? Well, you take on a variety of different occupations, as Manuel does, right? He becomes a baker and so on. He becomes eventually someone who recycles. The recycling footwear business, if you remember, is an enormously booming business because everything's more or less secondhand. And the novel itself can't quite figure out what type of novel it is. It doesn't know if it's a naturalist novel. It doesn't know if it's a modernist novel. It's enormously self-reflective, as we'll see. It talks about itself being in chronometric disorder from the beginning. Time itself seems to just stretch out, and in that kind of indolence and lassitude that afflicts a lot of people in the novel, then it would, right? Now, where are you going to organize some kind of sense of class unity from that? Who is it, in a sense, that you have to direct all your problems towards? Well, they lived as if sunk in the shades of a deep slumber, unable to form any clear notion of their lives without aspirations, aims, projects, or anything. Again, a tremendously ambivalent phrase, right? With a sniff of the Victorian moralizing middle class about it. The shirkers stuff, right? That we all should be a wee bit more aware of in the present climate, right? What are you, a shirker or are you a worker, right? That's the question in some respects that Baroka is trying to put down here. But he's ironizing that voice. This question of aspiration, which is of course a middle class value, right? Drag yourself up, get somewhere, is unachievable given the general economic conditions and the general social conditions that we've just witnessed in the previous two paragraphs. It's interesting in the backdraft again of Germinal. Consider, for example, this from part one, chapter four. This is Etienne, who's now initiated into the mine, more or less. Not a word was exchanged. So it's completely quiet, right? And already when you see things like that, given the stuff that I'm coming out with, you should be looking at this and thinking, right, okay, what is the representative gesture of this?